You're listening to
WGXC Accra
Hudson Catskill
90.7 FM.
The Cara Historical Society was established in 2009. Our mission is to collect, study, interpret, and preserve the history of the town of Cara, New York, for the educational and cultural enrichment of present and future generations. We love to bring history alive through our programming, such as our Hometown Heroes banner program, our State of the Union dinners, our Victorian teas. Each teach history while having fun. Members receive absolutely free our quarterly journal, the Cara Herald, which is jam-packed with historical articles, pictures, and society news. Everyone, however, can access the Cara Historical Society's Facebook page, which is a treasure trove of Cara history and memories. It's easy to become part of our historical family. Call Sylvia at 518-821-3852 or email the Cara Historical Society at carohistsociety@yahoo.com.
WGXC underwriting support has been provided by Dedicated Presentation Solutions. Allow DPS to turn your audiovisual how-do-eyes into here's-how-you-cans. Visit dedicatedpresentation.com or call 845-475-8465 for more information. Dedicated Presentation Solutions, your audiovisual partner.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Willa Kay of West Shokan, New York. Sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community.
Ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, friends and enemies, you're listening to me, your host, Norman Douglas. And the name of the show is Goodnight Norman, right here on WGXC 90.7 FM. Coming to you live from my makeshift home studio right here in beautiful downtown Hudson, New York. Banging out the towers. Somewhere around here, I think, Accra. Catskill. Cairo. Happy Hanukkah. Forgive me. I tried to suppress that, but I didn't. Tonight, this morning, here at the start of the High Holy Days, what the Romans called the fools. I don't know what the Egyptians called it. Those pesky 5 days at the end of the year that don't fit into the calendar of 13 moons or 12. At any rate, I'm going to give you some Neil Gaiman. I'm going to read you the first Neil Gaiman story that I ever came across. It's not my favorite Neil Gaiman story. My favorite, I think, would be too long to read on this, in this little 1 hour capsule that I have available to me. Maybe if I ever switch this over to a weekly type thing. I could do it in two parts. Really good story. And it would be really good to read right now for those high holy days. It's simple. Its title is Murder Mysteries. And I think it's in the same collection as this one, which is called Troll Bridge. The collection is Smoke and Mirrors. Obviously, Neil Gaiman has lots of
stuff. My name is Everett, and you are listening to WGXC Acre 90.7 FM.
Troll Bridge. They pulled up most of the railway tracks in the early 60s when I was 3 or 4. They slashed the train services to ribbons. This meant that there was nowhere to go but London, and the little town where I lived became the end of the line. My earliest reliable memory, 18 months old, my mother away in hospital having my sister, my grandmother walking with me down to a bridge and lifting me up to watch the train below, panting and steaming like a black iron dragon. Over the next few years, they lost the last of the steam trains, and with them went the network of railways that joined village to village, town to town. I didn't know that the trains were going. By the time I was 7, they were a thing of the past. We lived in an old house on the outskirts of the town. The fields opposite were empty, fallow. I used to climb the fence and lie in the shade of a small bulrush patch and read. Or if I were feeling more adventurous, I'd explore the grounds of the empty manor beyond the fields. It had a weed-clogged ornamental pond with a low wooden bridge over it. I never saw any groundsmen or caretakers in my forays through the garden and woods, and I never attempted to enter the manor. That would have been courting disaster, and besides, it was a matter of faith for me that all empty old houses were haunted. It isn't that I was credulous, simply that I believed in all things dark and dangerous. It was part of my young creed that the night was full of ghosts and witches, hungry and flapping and dressed completely in black. The converse held reassuringly true. Daylight was safe. Daylight was always safe. A ritual. On the last day of the summer school term, walking home from school, I would remove my shoes and socks and, carrying them in my hands, walk down the stony, flinty lane on pink and tender feet. During the summer holiday, I would put shoes on only under duress. I would revel in my freedom from footwear until the school term began once more in September. When I was 7, I discovered the path through the wood. It was summer, hot and bright, and I wandered a long way from home that day. I was exploring. I went past the manor, its windows boarded up and blind, across the grounds, through some unfamiliar woods. I scrambled down a steep bank, and I found myself on a shady path that was new to me and overgrown with trees. The light that penetrated the leaves was stained green and gold, and I thought I was in fairyland. A little stream trickled down the side of the path, teeming with tiny, transparent shrimps. I picked them up and watched them jerk and spin on my fingertips. Then I put them back. I wandered down the path. It was perfectly straight and overgrown with short grass. From time to time, I would find these really terrific rocks, bubbly, melted things, brown and purple and black. If you held them up to the light, you could see every color of the rainbow. I was convinced that they had to be extremely valuable and stuffed my pockets with them. I walked down the quiet golden green corridor and saw nobody. I wasn't hungry or thirsty. I just wondered where the path was going. It traveled in a straight line, and was perfectly flat. The path never changed, but the countryside around it did. At first, I was walking along the bottom of a ravine, grassy banks climbing steeply on each side of me. Later, the path was above everything, and as I walked, I could look down at the treetops below me and the roofs of occasional distant houses. My path was always flat and straight, and I walked along it through valleys and plateaus, and eventually, in one of the valleys, I came to the bridge. It was built of clean red brick, a huge curving arch over the path. At the side of the bridge were stone steps cut into the embankment, and at the top of the steps, a little wooden gate. I was surprised to see any token of the existence of humanity on my path, which I was by now convinced was a natural formation like a volcano. And with a sense more of curiosity than anything else, I had, after all, walked hundreds of miles or so, I was convinced, and I might be anywhere. I climbed the stone steps and went through the gate. I was nowhere. The top of the bridge was paved with mud. On each side of it was a meadow. The meadow on my side was a wheat field. The other field was just grass. There were the caked imprints of huge tractor wheels in the dried mud. I walked across the bridge to be sure. No trip-trap. My bare feet were soundless. Nothing for miles. Just fields and wheat and trees. I picked an ear of wheat and pulled out the sweet grains, peeling them between my fingers, chewing them meditatively. I realized then that I was getting hungry, and went back down the stairs to the abandoned railway track. It was time to go home. I was not lost. All I needed to do was follow my path home once more. There was a troll waiting for me under the bridge. "I'm a troll," he said. Then he paused and added more or less as an afterthought, "Fall roll the old roll." He was huge. His head brushed the top of the brick arch. He was more or less translucent. I could see the bricks and trees behind him, dimmed but not lost. He was all my nightmares given flesh. He had huge, strong teeth and rending claws and strong, hairy hands. His hair was long, like one of my sister's little plastic gunks, and his eyes bulged. He was naked, and his penis hung from the bush of gonk hair between his legs. "I heard you, Jack," he whispered in a voice like the wind. "I heard you trip-trapping over my bridge, and now I'm going to eat your life." I was only 7, but it was daylight, and I do not remember being scared. It is good for children to find themselves facing the elements of a fairy tale. They are well equipped to deal with these. "Don't eat me," I said to the troll. I was wearing a stripy brown t-shirt and brown corduroy trousers. My hair was also brown, and I was missing a front tooth. I was learning to whistle between my teeth, but wasn't there yet. "I'm going to eat your life, Jack," said the troll. I stared the troll in the face. "My big sister is going to be coming down the path soon," I lied, "and she's far tastier than me. Eat her instead." The troll sniffed the air and smiled. "You're all alone," he said. "There's nothing else on the path. Nothing at all." Then he leaned down and ran his fingers over me. It felt like butterflies were brushing my face, like the touch of a blind person. Then he snapped his fingers and shook his huge head. "You don't have a big sister. You've only a younger sister, and she's at her friend's today." "Can you tell all that from smell?" I asked. amazed. Trolls can smell the rainbows. Trolls can smell the stars, it whispered sadly. Trolls can smell the dreams you dreamed before you were ever born. Come close to me, and I'll eat your life. I've got precious stones in my pocket, I told the troll. Take them, not me. Look. I showed him the lava jewel rocks I had found earlier. Kalinka, said the troll. The discarded refuse of steam trains, of no value to me. He opened his mouth wide, sharp teeth, breath that smelled of leaf mold and the underneaths of things. Eat now. He became more and more solid to me, more and more real, and the world outside became flatter, began to fade. Wait! I dug my feet into the damp earth beneath the bridge, wiggled my toes, held on tightly to the real world. I stared into his big eyes. You don't want to eat my life. Not yet. I'm only 7. I haven't lived at all yet. There are books I haven't read yet. I've never been on an airplane. I can't whistle yet. Not really. Why don't you let me go? When I'm older and bigger and more of a meal, I'll come back to you. The troll stared at me with eyes like headlamps. Then it nodded. When you come back, then, it said, and it smiled. I turned around and walked back down the silent straight path where the railway lines had once been. After a while, I began to run. I pounded down the track in the green light, puffing and blowing until I felt a stabbing ache beneath my ribcage, the pain of stitch, and clutching my side, I stumbled home. The fields started to go as I grew older. One by one, row by row, houses sprang up with roads named after wildflowers and respectable authors. Our home, an aging, tattered Victorian house, was sold and torn down. New houses covered the garden. They built houses everywhere. I once got lost in the new housing estate that covered 2 meadows I had once known every inch of. I didn't mind too much that the fields were going, though. The old manor house was bought by a multinational. The grounds became more houses. It was 8 years before I returned to the old railway line, and when I did, I was not alone. I was 15, and I'd changed schools twice in that time. Her name was Louise. She was my first love. I loved her gray eyes, her fine, light brown hair, and her gawky way of walking, like a fawn just learning to walk, which sounds really dumb, and for which I apologize. I saw her chewing gum when I was 13, and I fell for her like a suicide from a bridge. The main trouble with being in love with Louise was that we were best friends, and we were both going out with other people. I'd never told her I loved her, or even that I fancied her. We were buddies. I'd been at her house that evening. We sat in her room and played Ratus Norvegicus, the first Stranglers LP. It was the beginning of punk, and everything seemed so exciting. The possibilities in music, as in everything else, were endless. Eventually, it was time for me to go home, and she decided to accompany me. We held hands innocently, just pals, and we strolled the 10-minute walk to my house. The moon was bright, and the world was visible and colorless, and the night was warm. We got to my house, saw the lights inside, and stood in the driveway and talked about the band I was starting. We didn't go in. Then it was decided that I'd walk her home, so we walked back to her house. She told me about the battle she was having with her younger sister, who was stealing her makeup and perfume. Louise suspected that her sister was having sex with boys. Louise was a virgin. We both were. We stood in the road outside her house, under the sodium yellow streetlight, and we stared at each other's black lips and pale faces. We grinned at each other. Then we just walked, picking quiet roads and empty paths. In one of the new housing estates, a path led us into the woodland, and we followed it. The path was straight and dark, but the lights of distant houses shone like stars on the ground, and the moon gave us enough light to see. Once we were scared when something snuffled and snorted in front of us. We pressed close, saw it was a badger, laughed and hugged, and kept on walking. We talked quiet nonsense about what we dreamed and wanted and thought, and all the time I wanted to kiss her and feel her breast and maybe put my hand between her legs. Finally, I saw my chance. There was an old brick bridge over the path, and we stopped beneath it. I pressed up against her. Her mouth opened against mine. Then she went cold and stiff and stopped moving. "Hello," said the troll. I let go of Louise. It was dark beneath the bridge, but the shape of the troll filled the darkness. "I froze her," said the troll, "so we can talk. Now I'm going to eat your life." My heart pounded, and I could feel myself trembling. "No." "You said you'd come back to me, and you have. Did you learn to whistle?"
"Yes."
"Well, that's good. I never could whistle." It sniffed and nodded. "I am pleased. You have grown in life and experience. More to eat. More for me." I grabbed Louise, a taut zombie, and pushed her forward.
"Don't take me. I don't want to die. Take her. I bet she's much tastier than me, and she's 2 months older than I am. Why don't you take her?"
The troll was silent. It sniffed Louise from toe to head, snuffling at her feet and crotch and breasts and hair. Then it looked at me. "She's an innocent," it said. "You're not. I don't want her. I want you." I walked to the opening of the bridge and stared up at the stars in the night. "But there's so much I've never done," I said, partly to myself. "I mean, I've never had sex, and I've never been to America. I paused. "I haven't done anything, not yet." The troll said nothing. "I could come back to you when I'm older." The troll said nothing. "I will come back, honest I will. Come back to me," said Louise. "Why? Where are you going?" I turned around. The troll had gone, and the girl I had thought I loved was standing in the shadows beneath the bridge. "We're going home," I told her. "Come on." We walked back and never said anything. She went out with a drummer in the punk band I started, and much later married someone else. We met once on a train after she was married, and she asked me if I remembered that night. I said I did. "I really liked you that night, Jack," she told me. "I thought you were going to kiss me. I thought you were going to ask me out. I would have said yes if you had. But I didn't." "No," she said, "you didn't." Her hair was cut very short. It didn't suit her. I never saw her again. The trim woman with the taut smile was not the girl I had loved, and talking to her made me feel uncomfortable. I moved to London,
And then some years later, I moved back again. But the town I returned to was not the town I remembered. There were no fields, no farms, no little flint lanes. And I moved away as soon as I could to a tiny village 10 miles down the road. I moved with my family. I was married by now, with a toddler, into an old house that had once, many years before, been a railway station. The tracks had been dug up, and the old couple who lived opposite us used it to grow vegetables. I was getting older. One day I found a gray hair. On another, I heard a recording of myself talking, and I realized I sounded just like my father. I was working in London doing A&R for one of the major record companies. I was commuting into London by train most days, coming back some evenings. I had to keep a small flat in London. It's hard to commute when the bands you're checking out don't even stagger onto the stage until midnight. It also meant that it was fairly easy to get laid if I wanted to, which I did. I thought that Eleonora, that was my wife's name. I should have mentioned that before, I suppose. I thought she didn't know about the other women, but I got back from a 2-week jaunt to New York one winter's day, and when I arrived at the house, it was empty and cold. She had left a letter, not a note, 15 pages neatly typed, and every word of it was true, including the P.S. which read, "You really don't love me, and you never did." I put on a heavy coat, and I left the house. And I just walked, stunned, and slightly numb. There was no snow on the ground, but there was a hard frost, and the leaves crunched under my feet as I walked. The trees were skeletal black against the harsh gray winter sky. I walked down the side of the road. Cars passed me traveling to and from London. Once, I tripped on a branch half hidden in a heap of brown leaves, ripping my trousers, cutting my leg. I reached the next village. There was a river at right angles to the road and a path I'd never seen before beside it, and I walked down the path and stared at the partly frozen river. It gurgled and plashed and sang. The path led off through the field. It was straight and grassy. I found a rock half buried on one side of the path. I picked it up, brushed off the mud. It was a melted lump of purplish stuff with a strange rainbow sheen to it. I put it into the pocket of my coat and held it in my hand as I walked, its presence warm and reassuring. The river meandered away across the fields, and I walked on in silence. I had walked for an hour before I saw houses, new and small and square, on the embankment above me. And then I saw the bridge, and I knew where I was. I was on the old railway path, and I'd been coming down it from the other direction. There were graffiti painted on the side of the bridge, "Fuck" and "Barry Loves Susan," and the omnipresent NF. Of the National Front. I stood beneath the bridge in the red brick arch, stood among the ice cream wrappers and the crisp packets, and the single sad used condom, and watched my breath steam in the cold afternoon air. The blood had dried into my trousers. Cars passed over the bridge above me. I could hear a radio playing loudly in one of them. "Hello?" I said quietly, feeling embarrassed, feeling foolish. "Hello?" There was no answer. The wind rustled the crisp packets and the leaves. "I came back," I said I would, and I did. "Hello?" Silence. I began to cry then, stupidly, silently, sobbing under the bridge. A hand touched my face. And I looked up. "I didn't think you'd come back," said the troll. He was my height now, but otherwise unchanged. His long, gonk hair was unkempt and had leaves in it, and his eyes were wide and lonely. I shrugged, then wiped my face with the sleeve of my coat. I came back. Three kids passed above us on the bridge, shouting and running. "I'm a troll," whispered the troll in a small, scared voice. "Roll, roll, roll, roll." He was trembling. I held out my hand and took his huge clawed paw in mine. I smiled at him. "It's okay," I told him. "Honestly, it's okay." The troll nodded. He pushed me to the ground, onto the leaves and the wrappers and the condom, and lowered himself on top of me. Then he raised his head and opened his mouth and ate my life with his strong, sharp teeth. When he was finished, the troll stood up and brushed himself down. He put his hand into the pocket of his coat and pulled out a bubbly, burnt lump of clinker rock. He held it out to me. "This is yours," said the troll. I looked at him, wearing my life comfortably, easily, as if he'd been wearing it for years. I took the clinker from his hand and sniffed it. I could smell the train from which it had fallen so long ago. I gripped it tightly in my hairy hand. "Thank you," I said. "Good luck," said the troll. "Yeah. Well, you too." The troll grinned with my face. It turned its back on me and began to walk back the way I had come, toward the village, back to the empty house I had left that morning, and it whistled as it walked. I've been here ever since, hiding, waiting, part of the bridge. I watch from the shadows as the people pass, walking their dogs, or talking, or doing the things that people do. Sometimes people pause beneath my bridge to stand, or piss, or make love, and I watch them, but say nothing, and they never see me. Full roll the old roll. I'm just going to stay here, in the darkness, under the arch. I can hear you all out there, trip-trapping over my bridge. Oh yes, I can hear you, but I'm not coming out. There you have it, first story I ever read in my life by Neil Gaiman. Famous for lots of stuff. I don't have to tell you what. Who know no go no, and who do know probably know more than I know. Damn, I wish I had read that story that I wish that I wanted to read. I probably could have just like squeaked it in, but I don't know. It's like 40 pages long. I mean, what does that mean? I haven't even told you the font size or anything. But anyways, yeah, it's longer than this one. Twice as long. But here's one that's also by Neil Gaiman, that probably I won't finish in the time that's allotted to me, the next 25 minutes, but maybe I will. It's called Foreign Parts. It's in the same collection of stories. What did I say the name of that collection is? Smoke and Mirrors. And the name of the story is Foreign Parts by Neil Gaiman. The venereal disease is disease contracted as a consequence of impure connection. The fearful constitutional consequences which may result from this affection, consequences the fear of which may haunt the mind for years, which may taint the whole springs of health and be transmitted to circulate in the young blood of innocent offspring, are indeed terrible considerations, too terrible not to render the disease one of those which must unhesitatingly be placed under medical care. It's Spencer Thomas, M.D., A Dictionary of Domestic Medicine and Household Surgery, 1882. Simon Powers didn't like sex. Not really. He disliked having someone else in the same bed as himself. He suspected that he came too soon. He always felt uncomfortably that his performance was in some way being graded, like a driving test or a practical examination. He got laid in college a few times, and once 3 years ago, after the office New Year's party. But that had been that, and as far as Simon was concerned, he was well out of it. It occurred to him once during a slack time at the office that he would have liked to have lived in the days of Queen Victoria, where well-brought-up women were no more than resentful sex dolls in the bedroom. Were no more than resentful sex dolls in the bedroom. They'd unlace their stays, loosen their petticoats, revealing pinkish-white flesh, then lie back and suffer the indignities of the carnal act. An indignity would never even occur to them that they were meant to enjoy. He filed it away for later. Another masturbatory fantasy. And Simon masturbated a great deal, every night, sometimes more than that if he was unable to sleep. He could take as long or as short a time to climax as he wished, and in his mind he had had them all. Film and television stars, women from the office, schoolgirls, the naked models who pouted from the crumpled pages of Fiesta, faceless slaves in chains, tanned boys with bodies like Greek gods. Night after night, they paraded in front of him. It was safer that way, in his mind. And afterward, he'd fall asleep, comfortable and safe, in a world he controlled, and he'd sleep without dreaming, or at least he never remembered his dreams in the morning. The morning it started, he was woken by the radio. 200 killed and many others believed to be injured, and now over to Jack for the weather and traffic news. Dragged himself out of bed and stumbled, bladder aching, into the bathroom. He pulled up the toilet seat and urinated. It felt like he was pissing needles. He needed to urinate again after breakfast, less painfully since the flow was not as heavy, and three more times before lunch. Each time it hurt. He told himself that it couldn't be a venereal disease. That was something that other people got. Something he thought of his last sexual encounter 3 years in the past, that you got from other people. You couldn't really catch it from toilet seats, could you? Wasn't that just a joke? Simon Powers was 26, and he worked in a large London bank in the securities division. He had few friends at work. His only real friend, Nick Lawrence, a lonely Canadian, had recently transferred to another branch, and Simon sat by himself in the staff canteen, staring out at the Docklands Lego landscape, picking at a limp green salad. Someone tapped him on the shoulder. Simon, I heard a good one today. You want to hear? Jim Jones was the office clown, a dark-haired, intense young man who claimed he had a special pocket on his boxer shorts for condoms. Sure. Here you go. What's a collective noun for people who work in banks? The what? Collective noun, you know, like a flock of sheep, a pride of lions. Give up? Simon nodded. A bunch of bankers! Simon must have looked puzzled because Jim sighed and said, bunch of bankers, bunch of wankers. God, you're slow. Then, spotting a group of young women at a far table, Jim straightened his tie and carried his tray over to them. He could hear Jim telling his joke to the women, this time with added hand movements. They all got it immediately. Simon left his salad on the table and went back to work. That night he sat in his chair in his bedsitter flat with the television turned off, and he tried to remember what he knew about venereal diseases. There was syphilis, which pocked your face and drove the kings of England mad, gonorrhea, the clap, a green oozing, and more madness, crabs, little pubic lice which nested and itched. He inspected his pubic hairs through a magnifying glass, but nothing moved. AIDS, the 80s plague, a plea for clean needles and safer sexual habits, but what could be safer than a clean wank for one into a fresh handful of white tissues? Herpes, which had something to do with cold sores. He checked his lips in the mirror, and they looked fine. That was all he knew. And he went to bed and fretted himself to sleep without daring to masturbate. That night he dreamed of tiny women with blank faces walking in endless rows between gargantuan office blocks like an army of soldier ants. Simon did nothing about the pain for another 2 days. He hoped it would go away or get better on its own. It didn't. It got worse. The pain continued for up to an hour after urination. His penis felt raw and bruised inside. And on the third day, he phoned his doctor's surgery to make an appointment. He had dreaded having to tell the woman who answered the phone what the problem was, and so he was relieved and perhaps just a little disappointed when she didn't ask, but simply made an appointment for the following day. He told his senior at the bank that he had a sore throat and would need to see the doctor about it. He could feel his cheeks burn as he told her, but she didn't remark on this, merely told him that he would be fine. When he left her office, he found that he was shaking. It was a gray, wet day when he arrived at the doctor's. There was no queue, and he went straight in. Not his regular doctor, Simon was comforted to see. This was a young Pakistani of about Simon's age, who interrupted Simon's stammered recitation of symptoms to ask, "Urinating more than usual, are we?" Simon nodded. "Any discharge?" Simon shook his head. "Why so? I'd like you to take down your trousers, if you don't mind." Simon took them down. The doctor peered at his penis. "You do have a discharge, you know." Simon did himself up again. "Now, Mr. Powers, tell me, do you think it possible that you might have picked up from someone a venereal disease?" Simon shook his head vigorously. "I haven't had sex with anyone." He had almost said anyone else, "in almost 3 years. "No?" The doctor obviously didn't believe him. He smelled of exotic spices and had the whitest teeth Simon had ever seen. "Well, you have either contracted gonorrhea or NSU, probably NSU, non-specific urethritis, which is less famous and less painful than gonorrhea, but it can be a bit of an old bastard to get treat. You can get rid of gonorrhea with one big dose of antibiotics. Kills the bugger off." He clapped his hands twice, loudly, just like that. "You don't know, then?" "Which one it is? Good Lord, no. I'm not even going to try to find out. I'm sending you to a special clinic which takes care of all of that kind of thing. I'll give you a note to take with you." He pulled a pad of headed notepaper from a drawer. "What is your profession, Mr. Powers?"
"I work in a bank."
"A teller?"
"No," he shook his head. "I'm in securities. I clerk for 2 assistant managers." A thought occurred to him. "They don't have to know about this, do they?"
The doctor looked shocked. "Good gracious, no."
He wrote a note in a careful round handwriting stating that Simon Powers, age 26, had something that was probably NSU. He had a discharge. Said he had had no sex for 3 years. In discomfort. Please could they let him know the results of the tests. He signed it with a squiggle. Then he handed Simon a card with the address and phone number of the special clinic on it. "Here you are. This is where you go. Not to worry. Happens to lots of people. See all the cards I have here? Not to worry. You'll soon be right as rain. Phone them when you get home and make an appointment." Simon took the card and stood up to go. "Don't worry," said the doctor. "It won't prove difficult to treat." Simon nodded and tried to smile. He opened the door to go out. "And at any rate, it's nothing really nasty like syphilis," said the doctor. The 2 elderly women sitting outside in the hallway waiting area looked up delightedly at this fortuitous overheard and stared hungrily at Simon as he walked away. He wished he were dead. On the pavement outside, waiting for the bus home, Simon thought, "I've got the venereal disease. I've got the venereal disease. I've got the venereal disease," over and over, like a mantra. He should toll a bell as he walked. On the bus, he tried not to get too close to his fellow passengers. He was certain they knew. Couldn't they read the plague marks on his face? And at the same time, he was ashamed he was forced to keep it a secret from them. He got back to the flat and went straight into the bathroom, expecting to see a decayed horror movie face, a rotting skull, fuzzy with blue mold, staring back at him from the mirror. Instead, he saw a pink-cheeked, bank clerk in his mid-20s, fair-haired, perfect skin. He fumbled out his penis and scrutinized it with care. It was neither a gangrenous green nor a leprous white, but looked perfectly normal, except for the slightly swollen tip and the clear discharge that lubricated the hole. He realized that his white underpants had been stained across the crotch by the leak. Simon felt angry with himself and angrier with God for having given him a, say it, dose of the clap, obviously meant for someone else. He masturbated that night for the first time in 4 days. He fantasized a schoolgirl in blue cotton panties who changed into a policewoman, then 2 policewomen, then 3. It didn't hurt at all until he climaxed. Then he felt as if someone were pushing a switchblade through the inside of his cock, as if he were ejaculating a pincushion. He began to cry in the darkness. But whether from the pain or from some other reason, less easy to identify, even Simon was unsure. That was the last time he masturbated. The clinic was located in a dour Victorian hospital in central London. A young man in a white coat looked at Simon's card and took his doctor's note and told him to take a seat. Simon sat down on an orange plastic chair covered with brown cigarette burns. He stared at the floor for a few minutes. Then, having exhausted that form of entertainment, he stared at the walls, and finally, having no other option at all, the other people. They were all male, thank God. Women were on the next floor up, and there were more than a dozen of them. The most comfortable were the macho building site types, here for their 17th or 70th time, looking rather pleased with themselves, as if whatever they had caught were proof of their virility. There were a few city gents in ties and suits. One of them looked relaxed. He carried a mobile telephone. Another, hiding behind a Daily Telegraph, was blushing, embarrassed to be there. There were little men with wispy mustaches and tatty raincoats, newspaper sellers, perhaps, or retired teachers, a rotund Malaysian gentleman who chain-smoked filterless cigarettes, lighting each one from the butt of the one before, so the flame never went out, but was transmitted from one dying cigarette to the next. In one corner sat a scared gay couple. Neither of them looked more than 18. This was obviously their first appointment as well, the way they kept glancing around. They were holding hands, white-knuckled, discreetly. They were terrified. Simon felt comforted. He felt less alone. "Mr. Powers, please," said the man at the desk. Simon stood up, conscious that all eyes were upon him, that he'd been identified and named in front of all these people. A cheerful, red-haired doctor in a white coat was waiting. "Follow me," he said. They walked down some corridors, through a door on which Dr. J. Benham was written in felt pen on a white sheet of paper, scotch-taped to the frosted glass, and into a doctor's office. "I'm Dr. Benham," said the doctor. He didn't offer to shake hands. "You have a note from your doctor." "I gave it to the man at the desk." "Oh." Dr. Benham opened a file on the desk in front of him. There was a computer printout label on the side. It said, "Registered July 90, male 90/00666, Power Simon, Mr. Born 12-63, single." Benham read the note, looked at Simon's penis, and handed him a sheet of blue paper from the file. It had the same label stuck to the top. "Take a seat in the corridor," he told him, "and nurse will collect you." Simon waited in the corridor. "They're very fragile," said the sunburnt man sitting next to him, by accent a South African or perhaps Zimbabwean, colonial accent at any rate. "I'm sorry." "Very fragile. Venereal diseases. Think about it. You can catch a cold or flu simply by being in the same room as someone who's got it. Venereal diseases need warmth and moisture and intimate contact." "Not mine," thought Simon, but he didn't say anything. "You know what I'm dreading," said the South African. Simon shook his head. "Telling my wife," said the man, and he fell silent. A nurse came and took Simon away. She was young and pretty, and he followed her into a cubicle. She took the blue slip of paper from him. "Take off your jacket and roll up your right sleeve." My jacket? She sighed. For the blood test. Oh. The blood test was almost pleasant compared to what came next. Take down your trousers, she told him. She had a marked Australian accent. His penis had shrunk, tightly pulled in on itself. It looked gray and wrinkled. He found himself wanting to tell her that it was normally much larger, but then she picked up a metal instrument with a wire loop at the end, and he wished it were even smaller. Squeeze your penis at the base and push forward a few times. He did so. She stuck the loop into the head of his penis and twisted it around the inside. He winced at the pain. She smeared the discharge onto a glass slide, and then she pointed to a glass jar on a shelf. Can you urinate into that for me, please? What, from here? She pursed her lips. Simon suspected that she must have heard that joke 30 times a day since she had been working there. She went out of the cubicle and left him alone to pee. Simon found it difficult to pee at the best of times, often having to wait around in toilets until all the people had gone. He envied men who could casually walk into toilets, unzip, and carry on cheerful conversations with their neighbors in the adjoining urinal, all the while showering the white porcelain with yellow urine. Often he couldn't do it at all. He couldn't do it now. The nurse came in again. No luck, not to worry. Take a seat back in the waiting room and the doctor will call you in a minute. Well, said Dr. Benham, you have NSU, non-specific urethritis. Simon nodded, and then he said, what does that mean? It means you don't have gonorrhea, Mr. Powers. But I haven't had sex with anyone for... Oh, that's nothing to worry about. It can be a quite spontaneous disease. You need not, indulge to pick it up. Benham reached into a desk drawer and pulled out a bottle of pills. Take one of these four times a day before meals. Stay off alcohol, no sex, and don't drink milk for a couple of hours after taking one. Got it? Simon grinned nervously. I'll see you next week. Make an appointment downstairs. Downstairs, they gave him a red card with his name on and the time of his appointment. It also had a number. Walking home in the rain, Simon paused outside a travel agent. The poster in the window showed a beach and the sun and three bronzed women in bikinis sipping long drinks. Simon had never been abroad. Foreign places made him nervous. As the week went on, the pain went away, and 4 days later, Simon found himself able to urinate without flinching. Something else was happening, however. It began as a tiny seed which took root in his mind and grew. He told Dr. Benham about it in his next appointment. Benham was puzzled. You're saying that you don't feel your penis is your own anymore, then, Mr. Powers? That's right, Doctor. I'm afraid I don't quite follow you. Is there some kind of loss of... Shit. Sensation? Simon could feel his penis inside his trousers. He felt the sensation of cloth against flesh, and in the darkness it began to stir. No, not at all. I can feel everything like I always could. It feels, well, different, I suppose. Like it isn't really part of me anymore. Like it... He paused. Like it belongs to someone else. Dr. Benham shook his head. To answer your question, Mr. Powers, that isn't a symptom of NSU, although it's a perfectly valid psychological reaction for someone who's contracted it. A feeling of disgust with yourself, perhaps, which you've externalized as a rejection of your genitalia. That sounds about right, thought Dr. Benham. He hoped he had got the jargon correct. He never paid much attention to his psychology lectures or textbooks, which might explain, or so his wife maintained, why he was currently serving out a stint in a London VD clinic. Powers looked a little soothed. I was just a bit worried, Doctor, that's all. He chewed his lower lip. What exactly is NSU? Benham smiled reassuringly. Could be any one of a number of things. NSU is just our way of saying we don't know exactly what it is. It's not gonorrhea, it's not chlamydia. Non-specific, you see. It's an infection and it responds to antibiotics. Which reminds me, he opened a desk drawer and took out a new week's supply. Make an appointment downstairs for next week. No sex, no alcohol. No sex, thought Simon, not bloody likely. But when he walked past the pretty Australian nurse in the corridor, he felt his penis begin to stir again, begin to get warm and to harden. Benham saw Simon the following week. Tests showed he still had the disease. Benham shrugged. Well, it's not unusual for it to hang on for this long. You say you feel no discomfort. No, none at all, and I haven't seen any discharge either. Benham was tired. A dull pain throbbed behind his left eye. He glanced down at the test in the folder. Well, you still got it, I'm afraid. Simon Powers shifted his seat. He had large, watery blue eyes and a pale, unhappy face. Well, what about the other thing, doctor? The doctor shook his head. What other thing? I told you, said Simon, last week. I told you the feeling that my penis isn't my penis anymore. Of course, thought Benham, it's that patient. There was never any way he could remember the procession of names and faces and penises with their awkwardness and their braggadocio and their sweaty, nervous smells. All their sad little diseases. What about it? Well, it's spreading, doctor. The whole lower half of my body feels like it's someone else's. My legs and everything, I can feel them all right. And they go where I want them to go. But sometimes I get the feeling that if they wanted to go somewhere else, if they wanted to go walking off into the world, they could, and they'd take me with them.
Well, I wouldn't be able to do anything to stop it.
Benham shook his head. He hadn't really been listening. We'll change your antibiotics. If the others haven't knocked this disease out by now, I'm sure these will. They'll probably get rid of this other feeling as well. It's probably just a side effect of the antibiotic. The young man just stared at him. Benham felt he should say something else. Perhaps you should try to get out more, he said. The young man stood up. Same time next week, no sex, no booze, no milk after the pills. The doctor recited this litany. The young man walked away. Benham watched him carefully but could see nothing strange about the way he walked. On Saturday night, Dr. Jeremy Benham and his wife Celia attended a dinner party held by a professional colleague. Benham sat next to a foreign psychiatrist. They began to talk over hors d'oeuvres. The trouble with telling folks you're a psychiatrist, said the psychiatrist, who was American and huge and bullet-headed and looked like a merchant marine, is you get to watch them try and act normal for the rest of the evening. He chuckled, low and dirty. Benham chuckled too, and since he was sitting next to a psychiatrist, he spent the rest of the evening trying to act normal. He drank too much wine with his dinner. After the coffee, when he couldn't think of anything else to say, he told the psychiatrist, whose name was Marshall, although he told Benham to call him Mike, what he could recall of Simon Powers' delusions. Mike laughed. Sounds fun. Maybe a tiny bit spooky, but nothing to worry about. Probably just a hallucination caused by a reaction to the antibiotics. Sounds a little like Topgrass syndrome. You heard about that one over here? Benham nodded and then thought and then said no. He poured himself another glass of wine, ignoring his wife's pursed lips and almost imperceptibly shaken head. Well, Capgras syndrome, said Mike, is this funky delusion. Whole piece on it in the Journal of American Psychiatry about 5 years back. Basically, it's where a person believes that the important people in his or her life, family members, workmates, parents, loved ones, whatever, have been replaced by, get this, exact doubles. Doesn't apply to everyone, they know, just selected people, often just one person in their life, no accompanying delusions either, just that one thing, acutely emotionally disturbed people with paranoid tendencies. The psychiatrist picked his nose with his thumbnail. I ran into a case myself a couple, 2-3 years back. Did you cure him? The psychiatrist gave Benham a sideways look and grinned, showing all his teeth. In psychiatry, doctor, unlike perhaps the world of sexually transmitted disease clinics, there is no such thing as a cure. There's only adjustment. Benham sipped the red wine. Later, it occurred to him that he would never have said what he said next if it wasn't for the wine. Not allowed, anyway. I don't suppose, he paused, remembering a film he'd seen as a teenager, something about body snatchers. I don't suppose that anyone ever checked to see if those people had been removed and replaced by exact doubles. Mike, or Marshall, or whatever, gave Benham a very funny look indeed and turned around in his chair to talk to his neighbor on the other side. Benham, for his part, carried on trying to act normally, whatever that was, and failed miserably. He got very drunk and started muttering about fucking colonials, and had a blazing row with his wife after the party was over, none of which were particularly normal occurrences.